Support for WMNF comes from our members in the Mahaffey Theater in St. Petersburg, presenting Chris Isaak Sunday, September 16th at 7 p.m. More at themahaffey.com or 727-893-7832. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll discuss various aspects of crows, ravens, magpies, and more with Tony Angel, the co-author of a fascinating new book, Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. First, though, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune highly relevant to that forthcoming conversation. This is Steve Martin with The Crow here on Talking Animals. This is The Crow from Steve Martin, a Corvid-related animal song to ease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name is Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from today's guest, Tony Angel, co-author with John Marsliff of the new book, Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. Both a scholarly work as well as an anecdotal, entertaining one that makes a convincing case for crows being enormously intelligent and emotional and surprisingly similar to humans. We'll discuss both the scientific and anecdotal, sometimes hilarious findings and stories included in Gifts of the Crow when we speak with Tony Angel in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Gifts of the Crow. And later on, we'll hear some more animal songs, including at least one more, that's right, crow song. By now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon, produced as always by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item involves saying, well, basically, happy summer solstice. It is the summer solstice today, and Randy did a great show sort of with that theme this morning. And, of course, you can find that on the archives, as you can, all music shows for 1 week's time at WMNF.org. And similarly, on Monday, Flea and It's the Music from noon to three did a solstice show. In this case, solstice is spelled S-O-U-L, I believe, because it was all cool soul music and newer soul artists. And anyways, fantastic show. Again, you can find that on the archives if you happen to miss that Monday afternoon. So what else I want to tell you? Well, one thing is I periodically mention Mark Maron's great podcast, WTF, celebrated. And again, we touted it here regularly. He's a past guest on Talking Animals. And of course, he does his podcast at the Cat Ranch, the so-called Cat Ranch. But more and more in recent months, he's beyond mostly comedy figures of one kind or another. He's been interviewing musicians on the podcast and doing some really great, great stuff. So this week, I just wanted to call your attention to, if you're a Jack White fan at all, he spoke with Jack White and, went down to, Jack's, third man office there and had a really great conversation. So again, it's Mark Maron's WTF, and you can find that at WTFpod.com. Now, as you've probably heard, we got a fun drive on the horizon. It's a mini-thon. It's not a week-long marathon. It's 3-4 days from July 10th through 13th. And 3 weeks from today, Talking Animals will be asking for your help in raising money for WMNF. So, but why wait? Why not support us in WMNF right now, right today? So you can go right to the tip jar. First, you just go to WMNF.org, our fabulous newly designed, redesigned website. Click on the full schedule link in the upper left-hand corner. Click on Talking Animals. Then, of course, that's Wednesdays at 11 a.m. And zoom up and click on the tip jar. If you can drop in $30, $50, $100, whatever you can swing would be great if you could do that today. It's just so much appreciated, and it just helps us go off to a nice head start 3 weeks from today when we have the fun drive and less than an hour to usually raise a lot of money. So that would be great if you could do that. And as always, of course, we'll have some exclusive Talking Animals premiums, both new and familiar. Familiar, of course, would be the week-long stay at the condo in Kauai. But one of the kind of cool new ones that we've worked out is an exclusive special tour of the Center for Great Apes in Wachula. It's an internationally recognized sanctuary for both chimps. And unusual about this one, also has orangutans. It's a 100-acre facility. And as a sanctuary, not typically open to the public at all, and they do not offer tours, but we've made kind of an arrangement for one only, behind-the-scenes tour for up to four people, where folks can see what goes on there, see the apes, and kind of close-up, check out one of their night houses, get a special presentation, and just sort of really get the kind of look and access that, again, is just not typically allowed in those kinds of settings. So, anyway, you can go to the centerforgreatapes.org to find out more about that facility and the kind of orangutans and chimps there. And, again, with all these things, we always offer a little bit of a incentive, a discount, if you pledge before the fun drive starts. So if you want to find out more about these and what sort of pledge prices they would involve, you can email us at talkinganimals@wmnf.org. And, of course, we'll also, not quite ready to announce it, but we'll also probably have, as we always do, tickets, and insanely good tickets to a Red Hot concert. And there's one, I think, that we're probably going to have that's... is a concert by someone who hasn't put out a record in a bunch of years and hasn't toured in a bunch of years, and I think it'll be a fairly hot ticket. So anyway, stay tuned for that. I'll tell you a bit more next week. But again, you can find out more directly and even be the first on your block to pledge if you want to get in touch with me, talkinganimals@wmnf.org. And separate from all that, again, why not hit the tip chart today? While we're listening, if you're listening online, just hit it right now. You can still listen. See? So easy. All right, and on to actual animal news. Ongoing story we reported on from the get-go. This comes from the Toronto Star. City councilors who support sending the Toronto Zoo's African elephants to the Paws Sanctuary in California insist the three should go despite a lab test this week showing that an elephant at the U.S. facility tested positive for TB. The Star learns the positive results for Annie, a 52-year-old Asian elephant of paws, are only preliminary and must be confirmed before any treatment starts. Annie has already been in quarantine for more than 3 years, along with two other Asian elephants, which tested positive for exposure to the disease. Paws co-owner Pat Derby told the Star by phone Thursday. This was last week, actually. City Council voted last year to send Toronto's elephants, three elephants, two paws near Sacramento. That decision led to an eight-month controversy over whether the sprawling sanctuary was the right choice. This all became so heated and public that the former game show host Bob Barker, a philanthropist and, of course, recent or semi-recent guest again on Talk Animals, recently insisted on a quote-unquote ironclad guarantee that his promised gift of $880,000 would be used to pay for a flight for elephants to California. And it goes on, and lots of resistance there from the zoo folks. And on a related note, a fairly historic trial and event is underway in Los Angeles this week. It began yesterday at Los Angeles County Superior Court, and after winding its way through the courts for 5 years, the lawsuit against the Los Angeles Zoo and its controversial $42 million elephant exhibit goes to trial. The lawsuit, filed by attorney David Castleman on behalf of now-deceased actor Robert Culp and real estate agent Aaron Leiter, seeks to end the display of elephants in the zoo's inadequate enclosure. Despite the millions wasted on the display, it utterly fails to meet the needs of Billy, Tina, and Jewel, and will only lead to more suffering and premature deaths. It says here, this trial will expose the realities of confinement for elephants at the Los Angeles Zoo and zoos more generally. So you can find out more the elephant by searching LA Alliance for Elephants. And, of course, they're looking for support of various kind if you're in the area or otherwise can help support the trial and its efforts. And also out in L.A. Last week, there was a benefit for PETA, a comedy benefit. Stand Up for Animals featured sets by Bill Maher, Jane Lynch, Fred Willard, Carol Leifer, and the aforementioned Mark Maron, and as well as Roastmaster General Jeffrey Ross. And and of course, there was a special veganized version of the Comedy Store's menu there, and the proceeds for the benefit will go towards PETA's work to stop animal abuse. So also in attendance there were Pink, Carrie Hart, Olivia Munn, Cloris Leachman, and many others, including Moby. And so more locally here in the fundraising vein. On Friday, this Friday, June 22nd, South Shore Felines fundraiser will be taking place from 5 to 7:30 p.m. at 4340 South Manhattan Avenue, Tampa. And it's at the thrift store there. And probably find out more by going to animalbasedcharities.org. All right, one more quick one, and then if we have time, we'll get into some others later on. But I just want to hit this one. If there's anything more impressive than a bear's size, it's intelligence. Bears can learn to ride bicycles, as we know. Use tools, and as new research shows, count. Scientists trained three American black bears to discriminate between groups of dots on a touchscreen computer. Two bears learned to pick the group with fewer dots, while the third learned to choose the group with more dots. In some trials, the group with fewer dots took up more space, and others the dots moved. All three bears could use the number of dots to guide their choices. But the bear trained to pick groups with more dots, performed better on its test, could also discriminate with moving dots. So overall, the bear's performance matched those of monkeys in previous studies, suggesting that animals can evolve impressive cognitive abilities without living in large social groups. And this may dovetail on some level with our conversation shortly about crows and their cognitive abilities. Right now, though, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. Was hoping to find a comedy piece to rent out a our all-crow theme, but didn't really like a couple of the choices so much. So we're going with something semi-close. This is Eddie Izzard with a piece called Parrots on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Long John Silver had an eye patch. What a cool guy. Also had a parrot on his shoulder. Parrots have never been in. They've never been hip because they suffer from the bimbo bird syndrome. They have great looking feathers, blues and really primary colours that kick out, but they look great, talk shite. That's their problem. Hello! 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 That's all they say. On occasion, pieces of eight! And pieces of eight is the equivalent of a bird on your shoulder going, a tenner! A tenner! A tenner!
Can you shut up, bird, about the money?
A tenner!
Minor bird, that's what you want on your shoulder. Black feathers matches your eye patch. Minor birds say cool things like, oh, look at that sunset. That's my minor bird. Is that an aurora borealis? Or am I a Dutchman? And birds fly, and we have aeroplanes, so that's the okay deal. But I think we have a fascination about hang gliding. When I remember seeing when James Bond did that hang gliding thing with the engine at the back, and we liked the hang, ooh, I think everyone would like to hang glide, but we're just worried about that PAF bit, where your belly flop hit the earth from 2,000 feet. That's the bit we're a little worried about. But there's no parachute and nothing, and you can't ring and say, steward. Yes, I've got a bit of an ache in my hang glider. It's just a PAF feeling. But, you know, birds fly, but no one's ever put a flighted bird, a bird that can fly, in an aeroplane. I mean, that, just birds would just find that so weird. You know, it'd be an amazing documentary. You know, bird flying along and looking at the aeroplane. Don't need to fly. Just stick me out. Hey, I can just balance on this chair. Hey. Hello. Other birds flying outside the aeroplane. Hey, what's he doing inside? Hello. Oh. I'm sorry. Oh, the white wine, please.
All right. That's Eddie Izzard with a piece called Parrots, taken from his album Definite Article. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Tony Angel. As I touched on earlier, Tony is co-author with John Marsliff of the new book, Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. It's a fascinating, often surprising, and entertaining book, and I'm excited to discuss it. So with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Tony Angel to Talking Animals. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning to you.
Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
My pleasure.
So, and congratulations on the book, which, as I've noted in a few places, I just found, of course, both scholarly, but also really anecdotal and at times, you know, highly amusing. So, and among the virtues, I guess, of this approach is just when I'm thinking, geez, I don't know if I'm bright enough to fully understand what they're saying here about the way information is traveling along the bird's cranial nerves or what functions the hippocampus serves in these birds. Boom! There's a fantastic anecdote that sort of makes it, pulls it together, and it may be a reference to Macaw, the raven you raised, and we're just sort of back fully engaged and sort of, you know, that understanding and awareness is achieved. So it's just a wonderful book.
Well, thank you very much.
And, sorry, go ahead.
Excuse me. That certainly is a good point as far as some of the cerebral matters. We felt that it was important to discuss this because the bird has suffered under the term bird brain for over 100 years since it was coined early in the last century, and it's anything but a simpleton, as the current research in neurobiological areas has demonstrated. Even though it's a very, very different brain than the mammalian brain, it has all of those elements of the brain that we have, and it shows the capacity for a bird like a corvid and crows and ravens in particular to do extraordinary things. So that's why we included it. We felt it was time to put some of these details out for the public to take a look at and consider, and then, as you point out, do it in a way that's understandable by pairing it with examples and experiments, observations that we've made that give clarity to what we're describing.
Absolutely. Well, so yeah, and again, there are so many wonderful anecdotes and observations about crows, ravens, and more. And by the way, we invite folks listening to call or email in with their own experiences or observations that we can talk about with Tony as well. But one of my favorites, for a few reasons, sort of comes towards the end of the book. Maybe you could sort of recount the story of Inde Drakberg in Sweden that launches the chapter on awareness.
Well, yes, this was one that we received not too long after we finished our previous book, In the Company of Crows and Ravens, about an ongoing phenomena that a couple had experienced outside of Stockholm. And we followed up, as we have on all of our reports, with the quest for details and authenticity, and this was certainly one that stood the test. But what happened was a battery, if you will, of magpies had been around the home of this couple, and the wife took to feeding them. But the husband was not particularly fond of the magpie hanging out, considering it a pest, and after a short period of time chased them off during the feeding. And what happened was the magpies apparently were taking their revenge on the husband's automobile. I should also inject that the magpies had gotten to ringing the doorbell of the home to alert the wife that it was time that they'd like their food.
Yeah.
Well, the husband experienced the wrath of the magpie, and they essentially let loose on the windshield of his automobile. So every morning when he would go out there, he'd have to clean that off or risk an accident because of the cloud of guano on his automobile.
Right.
They even switched car positions, but still the magpies were clever enough to select his car to receive their bombardier exercise, if you will.
Sure. Well, and by the way, I should say, with all the nice semantics you use there, that one of the things that in the book that you guys just used to describe it is that this guy's car was whitewashed by these birds who were irritated.
That,
yeah, which I love.
But
also what's so great is, as you kind of just, you know, describe this in the book, is that at first, before we know much about these people or the birds, is that there's this woman whose doorbell rings, and she goes out and there's nobody there, and she's looking around, and then it happens again, and finally she does figure out that it is one of these magpies. And also, maybe I'm misremembering this, Tony, but wasn't it because, like, there was such a difference between how the woman was and treated them and how the man was, beyond the whitewashing of the Mercedes, didn't they not ring the doorbell when they thought he was home?
Well, that's true. They selected their opportunities during the time when the husband would leave the house, and he was under the impression, of course, that he had driven the magpies off. And they had learned that there were two doors to the house, but they would go around to the other door to employ the use of the doorbell. Same doorbell on the front, apparently, that they'd witnessed people using and the door opening. And by virtue, I suppose, of observation and some deduction on their part, they employed the doorbell on the other side of the house to get the wife to go out and throw the food scraps. So you're absolutely right that in the absence of the husband, so he would continue to find the magpies still present, even though he thought he'd driven them off, because she continued to feed them.
Yeah. So again, it's both an amusing story on a bunch of levels, but it also, as the other stories throughout the book do, really kind of help underscore a point. In this one, it's about the magpie's awareness of kind of what was going on, and obviously the different views within the household there of you know, pro magpie and sort of anti magpie, and then what they did and what they were smart enough to figure out, like when they moved the car or when the guy wasn't around. So again, just another indication of just how sharp and the kind of thinking that goes on with these birds.
Well, not only that, but as we discuss in other parts of the book, the fact that insight can be employed by these species, which is something that historically we've always attributed only to primates and humans in particular.
Sure.
And the experiments that have been conducted with Betty, the New Caledonian crow, we describe in some detail where the crow had learned to retrieve a tool that would then be used as a tool to retrieve another tool, and that better tool would be used to secure the food. So there had to be some ability for that particular bird to think ahead of what was needed to solve a particular problem, and in this case, to secure the food. And that's a pretty unusual range of thinking for any species, for that matter, but using a tool to begin with, but then to get a tool with the tool to get the food.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, well, you know, one of the ways, obviously, we measure intelligence and problem solving in animals is the use of tools, if any. And as you've just noted here, I mean, this was sort of multifaceted use
exactly.
of tools. And again, I mean, the crows really shine there. And just kind of on a little simpler level, but again, just the sort of thinking and kind of creativity that I like that pops into my head now as we're talking about this is at the ferry landing in Puget Sound, some of those birds would drop clams in the path of the cars as they're, I guess, driving either on or off the ferry, I can't remember, but basically to smash the clams, and then once they would tool away and then the line would be on the other side, these guys would swoop in and have all kinds of nice clam meat opened up for them.
Right. This is something not too far from where we live out here in Puget Sound,
yeah.
where watching the crows drop, like gulls do, clams that they'd retrieved at low tide. I was a little bit perplexed initially because I didn't fly down to see if the shells had broken. But then after a little bit of time, I realized that they had accumulated a number of clams in that drive area where the exiting cars, those coming off the ferry, would drive over them and basically mince the clams for them. And then once they had exited, that drive stretch was clear of cars, the crows would go down and pick up the clams that were pretty much prepared for them. This is not unlike some of the observations in a somewhat similar way where the crows had learned in Japan to take walnuts and place them under the tires or in the path of cars at traffic lights that were holding the cars in place. Crows would hop out, put the walnuts down, hop back. Cars would get the green light, drive over the walnuts. At the next red light, the crows would go out and pick up the walnut meats.
Yeah. No, it's so impressive, and that one, and I guess maybe even more of the clam, and I thought, well, it's not that much of a leap to think pretty soon they're going to have chef hats on, and just, they're winning this all the way around. But let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tune in, we're speaking with Tony Angel, co-author and illustrator of the new book, Gifts of the Crow. If you'd like to ask Tony a question, offer a comment, or a story of your own about a crow encounter or observation, please call 813-239-9663 or email DJ@WMNF.org. So, Tony, the book title, Gifts of the Crow, of course, works on a couple of levels. Let's take a look at some of just the more literal level of gifts that crows have offered to people or allegedly offered, I guess, in some cases, because these things, too, are illuminating in various ways and sometimes startling. I mean, the one that I guess why I particularly used allegedly there was a place to start is the man named Gary Clark and what happened or ostensibly happened a few days after Valentine's Day a few years back. Maybe you could sort of share that with us.
Well, Gary gave us a call. He'd been feeding crows for years, and he said, you ought to get out here and see our crows. I've read your earlier book, and you might find this interesting because the crows have been leaving me gifts. Well, John and I were pretty reluctant to take that story at face value, but we went out, and sure enough, Gary had a terrific arrangement where he could bring in a small flock of crows every afternoon for a feed, and then he shared the story in some detail where one day he went out, and this was a couple of years before, and confronted the crows saying, hey, I'm always leaving you food. Why don't you give me something? And it just in a kind of a joking manner, he said he certainly wasn't of the belief that they were going to take him seriously.
Right.
And that very afternoon, which is around Valentine's Day, as it turned out, he went out, and of course the top of the feeder was cleaned up by the crows, but one thing remained, and it was a candy heart with the word love on it. And where did it come from? Well, that was the kind of question that John and I ran through a screen in every possible way.
Sure.
It could have been dropped by the crow in favor of picking up some food and left, but why didn't another crow take it? It could have possibly been dropped by a squirrel, but a squirrel would have been quick to another one would have retrieved it as well. Maybe a neighbor was playing a trick. Maybe his wife was playing a trick on him. All kinds of possibilities. Maybe Gary was playing a trick on us.
Right.
But what we discovered was that not only had this heart been left, but over subsequent months and years, all kinds of trinkets, little medallions, little sticks, shells, what have you, were left on that food tray after it had been cleaned off. And we had not conclusively felt that there was a specific crow that was responsible, but we couldn't help but believe that there was some kind of a gesture involved here, perhaps by one crow or two crows, where it was, as we do know, crows gift one another with mm-hmm. food. Perhaps there was some intent to return or to keep the pump primed, if you will, or seek reciprocity by leaving something as well as taking something.
Yeah.
And there again, I think it's attributing a level of intelligence and perhaps a little level of foresight to these species that's very remarkable. Gary was not alone. We got dozens of reports of people all over the country, for that matter, who reported that they, too, had received gifts, everything from rings to car keys to little items out of a Captain Crunch cereal box left on the feeders or left in areas where they fed. So this literal, as you say, gift of crow, of a crow, was the basis for the title of our book.
Yeah.
But we also metaphorically see that crows provide a lot of other gifts to us as well.
Sure, and themselves are quite gifted, is another way I read
well,
the title,
well, there you
too.
Go.
Yeah, as
birds go, for sure.
Right. Well, so Tony, I mean, I think it's safe to say another just enormously intriguing things to folks of sort of all levels of crow familiarity and expertise is, you know, these birds talking and, you know, on a show called Talking Animals, I guess it's incumbent on us to delve into this a little bit. Starting, I guess, with the correlation between their ability to speak and their ability to think, their brain power. Maybe you could address that a little bit.
Well, to begin with, I think it's important to realize that slitting a crow's tongue has nothing to do with its ability to imitate human sound or voice or words. That's, it all originates in its pharynx, which is way down in the tracheal tube. It's a dual apparatus, if you will, that allows them to blend sound with their air sacs and their lungs. They can sustain that sound. So they're really equipped to produce all kinds of sounds, and they do. And teaching a crow to talk, it's, you know, requires a bit of time and discipline, but they pick it up very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But what is remarkable about, and what episodes we've tried to include and have included in the book, not all of them, but a lot of them, is that they employ or they take human terminology and put it in context. And the context being getting a result from using human words. And we open with one chapter where a fellow in Montana, a biologist at Montana State, had been wakened at 5 o'clock in the morning by someone. First of all, the dog was barking, and then he heard someone calling, "Here, boy, here, boy." And he wondered, who in God's name is out there at 5 in the morning? When he goes out, he sees no one, very much like the magpie episode, the doorbell ringing and someone
yeah.
going out and nobody there but magpies. He did see the crow on the fence, and he waited it out, and sure enough, the crow was calling to his dog in the kennel and causing it to bark. Well, the further portion of the story is that once the crow left the man's yard, it went over to the campus at the university, and it then used the same hear boy to summon the dogs on campus. The crow was using a human phrase and getting a result, and it clearly knew that something was responding because it assembled the dogs for a period of over 2 weeks, and people observed this, and you have to wonder, well, what's the point? Why is it doing it? Is it being entertained?
Mm-hmm.
Is it exercising power? All kinds of possibilities, but it continued to do it habitually to the point where you had to conclude that it was getting some kick out of it. And that's the other part of what we put into the book. It's the degree to which crows share much of the same chemistry as we do in the brain. And if there was a pleasure in summoning the dog, or if there was a playfulness resulting in summoning the dogs or causing them to bark, endorphins flow through the crow's brain much as endorphins flow through our brain when we're playing or doing something that's entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah, really, I mean, there's so many things, and this is a perfect example where you think, I mean, some of this just, it must be cracking them up. I mean, they just must be, I mean, you know.
You think so, right?
Right, because calling the dog. Now, one thing about that, Tony, that this a good time to maybe try to clarify this, because I know in the book there's a, around some of this language and talking, imitating speech section, there, I think that you guys note that, that wild corvids don't seem to talk, but pet crows can easily be trained to talk. But in this case, with the guy in Montana, now, that didn't seem to be a pet crow, but somebody hanging around people more. Is that just kind of one of a sort of a blurry distinction at that point?
That particular crow was never connected to a specific owner.
Right.
But we did conclude that it had been a pet, or as you suggest, in such close proximity to an individual that they picked up the phrase. And it could have been a neighborhood crow listening. We just got an email here earlier in the week of a woman who indicated that a local crow that came to the feeder was using hello as part of its vocalization around the yard. Was it a pet at some point? We don't know. Had it been comfortable around people to the point where it was picking up the phrase and using it? That's a possibility as well. But typically, the close association over a period of time, like a pet, would give that crow an opportunity to pick up the phrase. There's an example in the book about a magpie that was a pet of an individual. And apparently it hadn't been taught the phrase so much as it had picked it up in the house when the woman called her magpie that was inclined to hide from her. She'd say, "Spike, Spike," and the magpie would say, "What? What?" Much like a youngster might respond when called,
sure,
wondering where the kid is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and as part of that too, I thought it was so interesting is because that example would be like, well, if that bird was exposed to people, you know, a kid or someone else saying what when people are called, I guess that bird would just sort of embrace that. But one of the other things that I thought was interesting about just sort of the more cognitive side of this is that you guys point out that as part of, you know, the ongoing premise of the book in terms of the parallel between, you know, crows and people is, I think you say that the shared reliance on lifelong learning to shape the vocabulary. So it's not just mimicking, although in that case it might have begun that way, but some of these other examples, it's being shaped over time and by experiences that they're having.
We use the example of my raven that I had for 2 years, Macaw, using what we would call a greeting, my greeting, to in turn use to me each morning. But that took a period of time, and it took a period of shaping in the raven's mind to come up with the phrase. And the neurobiological studies show how this stimulus of the moment, whatever it is, in an auditory or a visual way, basically circulates through the brain and is refined by memory and experience. And the articulation that the raven would use in its call note to me, which was "Hello, Macaw," I could detect a refinement over time. It simply got better and better and better, just like a youngster, a child would refine its his articulation or her articulation.
Sure.
The raven was doing the same thing. And they are extraordinarily long-lived birds, for birds, if you will. You know, crows into their 20s, ravens even older. So they learn throughout their lifetime, and in that learning, they refine their capacities to do everything from using tools to solving problems to using terms and words.
Yeah. Well, it's just so interesting. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Tony Angel, co-author of the new book, Gifts of the Crow. He's also an award-winning illustrator. We invite you to join the conversation. We have a few minutes left by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. And then when you talk about, you know, their lifespan being a bit unusual and some of the things that they maybe sharpen or get differently shaped over time. I guess also one thing this might be an apt moment to discuss too is the way that these birds respond to grief and loss.
Well, that is a fascinating phenomena. We had communications with a number of people, and we have observed ourselves instances where it appears that crows are having funerals.
Yeah.
their manner seems more somber, more subdued around a bird that has been killed. Watching this activity, birds will descend and walk around, taking, if you will, the measure of that dead cohort. And the idea that a funeral is actually being exercised is something that you really can't prove necessarily, but what you can, by observation, hypothesize is that not unlike the death of someone that's close to a human, we respond to that individual in a way that is going to determine how has the social structure changed, if you will.
Yeah.
How is my relationship with the rest of the population or family now going to adjust? How has this happened in the first place? What kind of danger existed to take this life?
Sure.
And learn from that. So it's a clear learning experience. And in that way, it's not unlike acknowledging the death of someone we're close to.
Right.
We learn from it.
Right. But at the same time, I think for people who aren't maybe as steeped in the world of these birds as you and John are, I mean, just, you know, it seemed more squarely in the rarefied territory of elephants and apes and stuff who have been demonstrated to have those kind of responses to loss and mourn sort of their, you know, their family members or friends. And
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I have witnessed individuals perched above a deceased associate and spending the entire day there in what appears to be contemplation of that death.
Yeah.
Now, unless we, you know, did a tracer and put the bird through a scan and saw that there was some activity in a emotional area of the brain, we wouldn't know for sure what was going on.
Yeah.
But it, as a supposition, it seems reasonable to consider that there is a grief exchange, a moment of exchange there between that animal that sees the death or other animals around the death of someone they were close to.
Sure. Well, let's, before we run out of time, let's get at least a caller or two involved in this. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Tony Angel.
Jesus, Clay from Land O'Lakes. I have interesting stories about crows, especially one that I had for some time named Mortimer. When I got him from a lady who gave him to me, she'd raised him after he got blown out of a tree, and only feeding him McDonald's cheeseburgers, saying that's what his favorite food was. When I got him, he didn't have full feathers on him or anything, so I changed his diet. I gave him crickets and worms and cat food, basically, and fruit and all kinds of good stuff, and he grew a full set of feathers, but he didn't know how to fly. So I taught him to fly. That was an experience, throwing him up in the air out in the field with a string tied to his leg so that I could get him to fly. And he did finally learn to fly. The interesting thing, though, when I heard you saying about the speech of crows, is that he had language when he came, but all of his language was in context. If someone knocked at the door, he'd tell them, come in. And if the telephone was ringing, he'd go, the phone is ringing, phone's ringing. And when it got dark, he'd go, bedtime, everybody go to bed.
He
had a lot of language. He was a very, very, very special bird, named Mortimer, by the way.
Well, how long did you have the bird?
I only ended up having for 3 years. I ended up working out of town, and I had left a young lady to be taking care of my animals, because I have lots of them, and she, in her infinite stupidity, decided to take the bird to show it to people, and took it into their trailer where the ceiling fan was on, and you can guess the rest.
Wow. All right. Well, I'm sorry about Mortimer, but thanks for sharing the other part of this.
Well, and I've observed a lot of nature, too. I'm a big fan of observing nature, and I've seen some amazing things from crows. One of the things I see all the time is they really test their chances with cars. They'll stand in the road and eat until the very last second, and barely escape.
Yeah, well, thank you for your call. In fact, yeah, there's a story in the book about sort of some kind of feast on the road and sort of ducking down and being, you know, sort of seemingly imperiled, but they would just duck down low enough when the car came by and then just resume eating like unfazed by it all.
Yeah, the car went right over them on Interstate 5 out here on the West Coast.
Right. All right, let's try to take one more call here before we run out of time. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Tony Angel.
Howdy.
Hi. Quick question for Tony or comment?
Yeah, well, the bit about funerals. I witnessed something similar to that. I'm in St. Louis these days, and the crows are finally coming back after all the West Nile problems we've had. But this goes back to San Francisco in the early 80s, and I was walking through Golden Gate Park, and there was a dead crow laying on the sidewalk. And I decided, well, maybe I should move him under a bush so some punk rock kids don't try to make a collage out of him or something. They've always been my favorite birds. And as I was doing so, trying to load him onto my clipboard and get him over here under a bush, I was getting dive bombed. I mean, everybody else was really, really upset in the rookery there, and for me to be messing with their friend at all. So they didn't actually strike me, but they got very, very close, you know, and it's like, yeah, so they were mourning their buddy.
Sure, and sending you a clear message not to interrupt the proceedings.
What time of year was this?
There aren't any seasons out there.
Was it in the spring or summer?
I think it might have been actually springtime, yeah.
Well, a couple of things could have happened, and I'll make it quick, but certainly there was kinship, altruism being demonstrated, protecting a deceased. And it may well have been a younger bird, and what that time of year we often experience is parents who are protecting their young from what they consider serious threats. And
yeah, this guy was pretty much full-size, fully fledged.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was just a buddy, I guess.
Yeah.
Everybody else. I wanted to say that I have read some of your stuff before, and also Bernd Heinrich, Mind of the Race.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're all pretty tight with each other, apparently, and I really enjoy everything I read about my favorite totem birds.
Well, very kind of you to offer that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. All right, so Tony, well, we're just sort of in the tail end of our time, but I guess one thing, we sort of touched on it, and when you're talking about sort of their sense of play, but of course one section in the book is devoted to frolic, and that these birds really tend to be playful, and one of the things I posted on Facebook as a prelude to our conversation was this clip of one bird sledding in snow on the roof of a house in Russia.
Yes.
And you think, okay, at the beginning, you think, okay, I mean, you know, it's a bird going down something that he's found. But then when he picked at the bottom of the run, if you will, when he picks whatever sled he or she has fashioned and flies back up to the top and does it again, you think, okay, well, I'm seeing somebody snowboarding basically.
And this was, something that came late in the completion of the book. It's a phenomena that we wished we could have seen what the Hooded Crow had done with that top or that lid,
mm-hmm.
the big lid. Once it flew over on the other side of that snow-covered rooftop, it would have determined, was it sledding on the other side? Was it keeping up the activity? But there was enough repetition that it was pretty convincing that it was getting an endorphin high,
yeah.
like we might sledding down a snow hill.
Sure. No, it was just terrific. And anyway, it's just another sense of the range. Since we're just talking about their grieving and their funeral kind of procession, it seemed kind of nice to balance it out with them snowboarding. So we had a quick email here saying, great interview. I have a newfound respect for crows. Thank you. And Tony Song, you were about to say something, then we'll probably
just
about out of time.
Just that the range of comparable behaviors and feelings that we share with this highly evolved family of birds is astounding.
Yeah.
And the gifts of learning from them and discovering more about nature and our connection to the larger world is an open invitation, and that's what crows can provide, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Tony. Well, again, this has been Tony Angel, co-author, along with John Marsliff, of Gifts of the Crow, a new book. It's extended title or full title is How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. And again, I think, as this conversation probably suggested, really a fascinating read, and there's all kinds of things we didn't even get into, including crows and some of their friendships and relationships with other animals, some of which are quite unlikely, etc. So, anyways, that's available anywhere where you can get books. You can get Gifts of the Crow. Tony, again, thank you for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
My pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and it's just about time to play Name That Animal Tune. And this is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WMNF member to win, and there'll be a prize, a copy of Gifts of the Crow, not coincidentally, to the first person who calls in the correct title of this Corvid-related song, or ditty, maybe, more accurately, to 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune. I'm Talking Animals.
We're all set for the first cartoon. You'll just love it.
All right. Well, hopefully that last part might give you some hint. Yeah, probably have to be of a certain vintage to recognize that. But, well, we got a few callers right off the bat. Let's take them real quick and see where they came. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal, Tim?
Flight of the Bumblebee?
No. No. I will give you a further clue, in case you want to quickly guess before we move on. It's sort of the opening of a cartoon show.
Tom and Jerry?
No, but you're so close. You want to take one more guess? I feel bad moving on. One more quick guess.
They're crows, the Heckle and Jekyll.
There you go, sir. It's the theme, the opening theme for the Heckle and Jekyll show. What is your first name?
My first name is Dor.
Dor, D-O-R?
R?
D-O-R. Okay, cool. Dor, I'm going to come back and get your information and send you off a copy of Gifts of the Crow. Good work. Good deductive reasoning yourself there, sir.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, June 27th. I hope you'll join me for that. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net. Where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Take a moment, like us on Facebook, will you? It's Talking Animals Radio Show is the full name on Facebook. Or follow us on Twitter, that's at Duncan Strauss. All that is easy to do just by going to talkinganimals.net. There's links to the whole shebang. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Busalis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And if you'd like to have more news and information, the Tom Hartman Show is starting up at noon on 88.5 HD3 online at WMNF.org/thesource. Or if you like music, then you're exactly in the right spot. Stay tuned for the wonderful Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. We're closing out today's show one more Crow song. The great Shamika Copeland will be here in September helping WMNF celebrate its birthday. Keep an eye out for that. Right now, we're going to hear Shamika doing a wonderful version of Joni Mitchell's Black Crow, taking us up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa. Thanks for listening. Speaking of the next week, 11 a.m. on Wednesday, Talking Animals. Thanks for listening.
There's a crow flying black and ragged from tree to tree. As black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on something shiny. I'm like a black crow flying in a blue sky. I took a ferry to the highway and I drove to a pontoon plane. Took a plane to a taxi, and a taxi to a train. I've been traveling so long, how am I gonna know my home when I see it again? I'm like a black crow flying in a blue sky. Search of love and music, my whole life has been illumination, corruption, and diving, 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 diving down to pick up on every shiny thing.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.